And our next case this morning is number 073386, Camp versus TNT Logistics.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Ginsky. I represent the plaintiff Lola Camp, who is a professional truck driver that sustained an injury when she opened the side-by-side rear doors of her semi-trailer. During transit, cargo had shifted and the cargo started to come out. My client slammed the door and ended up injuring her shoulder and arm. There are two entities legally responsible for my client's injuries. The first is Trelleborg, which was the manufacturer of the parts, the cargo, portions of which started shifting, and also Trelleborg, whom loaded that particular truck and loaded it improperly. Additionally, TNT, which designed the load, it's a logistics company that designed the load, knew the load wasn't fully cubed or self-securing, didn't place any type of load racks, dunnage, cargo netting in the truck prior to my client's injury. Because summary judgment was granted, the basis of this court's review is de novo, with the exception of the district court's striking of the plaintiff's brief at the trial court level. That's judged or reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard. There are three errors that the district court made.
Before we get to the errors, could you clarify, please, the basis of your complaint? Is it based on state law, or are you alleging that there is some kind of an implied cause of action based on federal law here for violation of the Motor Carrier Act?
Your Honor, the basis of the complaint against both Trelleborg and TNT, the two defendants, is there's a common law action under state law against each of them, and then there's a statutory cause of action under the safety regulations against each of them.
And you base the district court, that's a federal claim, is it?
No, it's evidence. Violation of the Federal Motor Safety Regulations is evidence of negligence.
So your claims are based on state law?
Yes.
Both of them?
Yes.
I see.
There are three errors that the district court made in granting summary judgment. The first is the finding that there was a lack of duty on behalf of both defendants. The second error that the district court made was a finding that the defendant, as a matter of law, was guilty of contributory negligence. And the third error was the striking of plaintiff's brief at the trial court level. And taking that third issue first, the striking of plaintiff's brief, as I indicated earlier, this court reviews that decision by the district court on an abuse of discretion standard, and the reasonable man standard therefore governs. In this particular case, what the district court held was that none of the facts cited by the plaintiff could be considered by the court because of a formatting error with respect to the written brief. There is a local court rule in the Central District of Illinois, which Local Rule 7 mandates that disputed facts be set forth as disputed with a citation to the record as to the basis of the dispute. In this particular case, the plaintiff did list all of the disputed facts, but then had a header that said additional disputed facts, and then went through and, referring to the record, cited a couple of dozen, if not more, points that were disputed. And one of the issues that probably will impress this panel here this morning is that when I speak and talk about the record and the facts that were established, counsel for the defendants, the appellees, will state facts that completely contradict what the plaintiff says. The point being, there was obviously a genuine issue of material fact. But with respect to striking the plaintiff's brief, the failure to exercise discretion is itself an abuse of discretion. And it was improper here for the district court to simply state that all of the facts established by the defendants in their motions for summary judgment were uncontradicted and had to be assumed as true. That's an abuse of discretion when, in fact, the plaintiff's brief did set forth and cite to the record all of the disputed facts in this case. Taking the second error that the district court made, that was the finding of contributory negligence as a matter of law. The finding of contributory negligence is a question of fact for the jury. That's not a question of law that can be determined by the court peremptorily at the at a pretrial stage. As I've indicated, there are a number of disputed facts in this case that will become evident as my opponents address the court. But it is improper for the district court judge to usurp the position of the jury and decide contested issues of facts on a summary basis. The primary holding of the district court was that there was a lack of duty, that the plaintiff had failed to establish that either Trelleborg as the shipper or TNT as the motor carrier had a duty to the plaintiff, in this case the truck driver, my client. And the district court is incorrect on that point. Firstly, with respect to the shipper, Trelleborg, my client, when she was at her last stop, knew that the load was not self-securing and that there was one pallet of these automobile parts that was going to shift in all probability during transit. And as a consequence, she said, "It will not ride. I can't take this." On this particular trip, the Trelleborg employed the forklift operator that was loading the truck. Trelleborg's forklift operator said, "You know, I think you're right. I don't think that this will ride safely." The forklift driver got his supervisor, who came and looked at the situation and said, "I agree with the both of you. This isn't going to work." And then they all started getting on the phone and making calls.
Then they offered to unload it.
They did offer to unload it.
Now, whose decision is that?
That is TNT. That is the motor carrier in this case.
Well, what about Camp?
She does not have authority, and the record is replete with testimony in support of this position. She does not have authority to say, "I won't take that." She'll lose her job if she does not take what TNT tells her needs to be delivered.
So what? So where does that put Shelburne? Or, I'm sorry, Trelleborg.
Trelleborg? At least Trelleborg in the position of being the shipper. And with reference to common law duties that shippers have, probably the best case that has been cited to the court was cited by plaintiff in her appellant's brief. It is the Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S, versus Goodyear case. It's a 1997 case from the Northern District of Illinois that is factually identical to the facts of this case. That is where the driver went to, I think it was Akron, Ohio, to pick up a load of tires, automobile tires, comes back to Chicago, opens the back door, and the tires come out and cause injury.
That, counsel, is, if I've got the case correct, is not a precedential opinion. That's an unpublished district court opinion. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's not a precedential decision of the Illinois courts that we would look to for guidance.
Well, and that's not the only case that the plaintiff cited for that proposition, Your Honor.
Do you have some Illinois case law from the Illinois Supreme Court?
No. There are no Illinois Supreme Court cases that have... No.
All right. Let's back up a little and reconceptualize this. You've got two common law claims here,
yes.
Both negligence-based.
Yes.
One based on the alleged violation of the Motor Carrier Act by...
Correct.
...each of the defendants. And the district court ruled against you on that because neither of the defendants is a motor carrier within the contemplation of the Act, and so had no duties under the regulations, which is the theory that you've advanced on that claim. What's your response to that?
The district court is probably correct with respect to that decision as against Trelleborg. I think Trelleborg logically, is not a motor carrier in this context. I think they are exclusively a shipper, and on remand, the plaintiff would be abandoning that claim.
Okay.
But the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations specifically state that under the aiding and abetting regulation, that applies to all persons, not, that's more broadly defined, not to just motor carriers. Now,
if aiding and abetting is your theory, that's a common law claim. You've indicated in response to Judge Ripple's questions that you've advanced two common law claims under Illinois law, and under Illinois law and the restatement, an aiding and abetting claim is a claim for injuries to third parties, not injuries to the primary tortfeasor, which would, in this scenario, be your client.
Well, if you accept the district court's finding that my client was contributorily negligent, which is not up to the court with all due respect.
Any findings, and district courts don't make findings on summary judgment, or they're not supposed to.
I agree with that.
Okay.
But in this case,
she's the primary actor here. She's the primary actor. She's the primary tortfeasor, and the aiding and abetting cause of action at common law lies for injured third parties.
I understand
the concerted
action distinction.
Theory, and a third party who's injured by the concerted action of others who are aiding and abetting one another or a primary tortfeasor has a claim against the aiders and abettors. The primary actor doesn't have a claim.
I understand the distinction that the court's making. I still believe, and I think that the case law supports it in the brief that we have submitted, has the supporting case law that the loader, the shipper, trelleboard, has to load the cargo in a reasonable manner so that injury doesn't occur when the cargo is being unloaded.
Well, who tells them not to unload it?
I'm sorry?
When they offer to unload it, who tells them not to unload it?
TNT, the logistics company that's the motor carrier here. And when counsel for TNT addresses this court, he will be sure to say that TNT was not in the position of a motor carrier, that they were simply a broker here. But that's not accurate because broker, as defined by the regulations, excludes motor carrier. And there's no argument but that TNT is a licensed motor carrier. They have
not
a federal...
Not for purposes of this transaction.
I disagree with that, Your Honor, and here's why. A broker is not a party to a transaction. In other words, if I'm going to broker a real estate deal between two of the justices here today, we have
to take it into the real estate context because that's not where we're at here. We're in the
we have two parties to a contract. The broker is neither the offeree or the acceptee. The broker does not enter into the contract. Here, TNT had a contract with Mitsubishi, the auto plant owner. To supply all of these parts. They were not a true broker. What they turned around and did then, after contracting directly with Mitsubishi to supply these parts, they turned around and subcontracted to DeKaiser this.
That's the definition of a broker.
I disagree, Your Honor. A broker
is a company who arranges or offers to arrange the transportation of property by an authorized motor carrier. The motor carrier here is DeKaiser, and your client was an employee of DeKaiser or leased to DeKaiser.
Leased to DeKaiser. That gets a little bit confusing, but that's not relevant.
Right. I understand that, but I just quoted you the statutory definition of broker, and that's TNT, right?
I disagree. The broker cannot be a party to the contract, and the contract to supply the parts to Mitsubishi is between TNT and Mitsubishi. Now, TNT does turn around and subcontract the actual driving to Lola Camp and her employer, whomever that employer is. But the safety regulations that have been promulgated at the federal level make the obligations of the motor carrier non-delegable. It does not matter that Lola Camp and DeKaiser are operating under an independent ICC number. The fact remains that the contract between Mitsubishi and TNT makes TNT the motor carrier.
Did you make a non-delegable duty argument in the district court?
Yes.
This is... not familiar to me from having read your briefs here, that that terminology was invoked.
It was, Your Honor. Let me see if I can find exactly where in the brief.
Rebuttal time. Maybe you'd like to save that for rebuttal.
I would.
Actually, your time has expired. I'll give you a minute or two. Mr. Cassidy.
Court, counsel. My name is Drew Cassidy. I'm an attorney for Trelleborg, Inc. There are several issues were raised by Trelleborg at the district court, which, of course, we don't want to waive here, but the issue of duty is what brings us here today, and it's the district court's finding that there was no duty owing from Trelleborg to Loa Camp, and so that's where I would like to address the issue. The district court found a lack of duty in both respects under plaintiff's claims. Plaintiff tries to create a duty under a statutory violation as well as the common law. Court ruled against them in both respects, and we submit the district court was correct in both respects. Before I get to the analysis and the correct analysis, I do want to address counsel's argument that his brief was stricken. I think that's a little misstatement as to what happened. What the district court did was applied a local rule which stated that our undisputed facts set forth in our brief and supported by the record, which plaintiffs simply claim to be undisputed without pointing to the evidence in the record that makes them or puts them in dispute, that he wasn't going to consider that. So the court simply said, I'm not going to search the record for you. You haven't shown me a factual dispute on the things you say are disputed, so I'm not going to consider them disputed. The first issue sounds like it's been abandoned as to whether or not there's a statutory duty owing, so I will not address that and only address the common law, Your Honor. Counsel wants to phrase the court's finding that the court found as a matter of law that Loa Camp was guilty of contributory negligence. I believe that's a misstatement of the court's analysis. Plaintiff relies on several cases in making a blank statement that there's a duty on a shipper to load safely and securely. Most of the argument in the brief, however, only points out how that might have been breached. There's no case law cited which says this is a blanket duty on the part of a shipper, that no matter what they're told by the driver, no matter what they're told by the company who's receiving the goods, that this duty persists. To the extent that plaintiff undertakes a duty analysis at all, it is done in a vacuum and only looks or fails to look at the knowledge and involvement of the plaintiff herself in the facts of this case. They want to argue that her knowledge is a question for the jury, and it was improperly decided. I submit that that is a wrong statement of the law. An existence of duty is always a question of law. Common law duty in Illinois is essentially, simply stated, the obligation to act in such a fashion as to not create an unreasonable risk of harm. Important factor in there is that it is an unreasonable risk. Now, the open and obvious issue is not a comparative fault issue as plaintiff would portray it, but it becomes part of the duty analysis because the law views it as reasonable for an actor to assume that others will avoid a risk of which they have full knowledge.
Has the open and obvious doctrine in Illinois been applied outside of premises liability or the products liability context to knowledge?
I'm most familiar with them, certainly in the products area and conditions of land, Your Honor. No, but the analysis that's undertaken in those cases comes back to the basic rationale that it's reasonable to assume somebody won't expose themselves to a known risk. And therefore, you're not creating an unreasonable risk by asking them to go forward. It goes back to the fact that the primary consideration in any duty analysis is foreseeability. And the law doesn't expect any of us to foresee, again, that another will knowingly expose themselves to a known danger. Therefore, in considering this duty analysis, the issue of obviousness is whether or not the plaintiff appreciated the risk, because if the plaintiff did so, it ceases to be an unreasonable risk of harm. the evidence in this case is very clear that Lola Camp fully understood the risk. She told them that without four cubes going in, this wouldn't be self-securing, that it would not ride. Your Honors have mentioned that not only did the Trello Board people offer to take the third cube off, initially they refused to put it on. And she agreed. And it was only after the calls were made to others that Lola Camp, who's in charge of the load, says, put it on. Even after it's put on, Trello Board continues to say, we'll take it off for you. We will hold it here for an expediter. Expediter being another truck that's sent to pick up these odd loads. That was rejected by the driver. Whether or not somebody else may have been guiding her is not relevant to Trello Board. The driver at that point is responsible for the load. She said, I'm taking it. She testified she was fully aware that by putting on the third cube without a fourth, that it could shift, and that the concern to her was that the load could fall when she opened the door. So she fully appreciated the risk here. She knowingly encountered it on the other end. And under that, those facts, there is simply no duty owing from Trello Board. The Holmes case, and I appreciate Your Honor recognizing it has no precedential value, but I do think it's important to mention it in the sense that there is a big distinction there. And the big distinction in that case, which doesn't go to the duty analysis that the court correctly undertook in this case, is that was a sealed load. The driver picked up a sealed load, did not know how it had been loaded, didn't know what was behind those closed doors. So you're not getting to the plaintiff's knowledge. And the whole lack of duty here, as found by the district court, is that the plaintiff was fully aware of the risk and chose herself to encounter it. We would submit that that's a correct determination by the court and would ask that you affirm the district court's ruling.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Koala.
Good morning, Your Honors. TNT in this case is sued under what I believe to be two theories that were addressed to Judge McDade, the district court judge in this case. And I think the most important document in the whole case is the plaintiff's response to the motion for summary judgment, not because of what's in it, but because of what's not in it. I would say fairly the vast majority of what's being argued to Your Honors is nowhere found in any of the pleadings put before the district court. For example, if you look for the plaintiff's response brief in front of Judge McDade, all he says is that there are common law duties that were owed to my client by TNT. He doesn't state what the duty is, what the scope of the duty is, how it arose, or cite any case law. And when Judge McDade granted summary judgment, he looked at what was before him, the plaintiff's response, and all of that information was lacking. All of the information about a four-prong duty analysis was never in there. Some consideration of those issues weren't in there. There was no discussion of special relationships between the parties that could give rise to a common law duty. Taking a step back, let me start with the issue first of what the Federal Motor Vehicle Standard requires in terms of a broker. The definition properly cited by the district court is that a broker is someone that arranges for transportation. It is not a party that does the actual transportation itself. The decision rendered in this case, based upon the Smith case and the Schramm case, which are relevant federal district court opinions in interpreting the definition of a broker as applied to a logistics company, state that if you arrange to have product loaded, you're not covered by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety regs. And there's a logical reason for that. If you're not the party that's actually moving the load, that can see the load, that can put the truck on the road, that is where they draw the distinction. And in this case, TNT is the broker, only arranged for the load, and DeKaiser moved the load. So the decision, the starting issue here is, was TNT a motor carrier or not? And the answer is they were not. There is no precedent case law given to you by the appellant in this case, indicating that there are any divergent opinions on this issue. The argument that was made to the lower court was twofold. First of all, it was argued that the plaintiff had hired two experts, one expert, who was a truck driver for years, who believed that her interpretation of whether or not TNT was a broker was something that the court needed to consider. And the court said, in deference to her driving history, I'm not going to follow her affidavit as to what federal courts use to determine whether TNT is a broker or not. And I think that's clearly a logical choice by the district court judge. The second issue that was presented was the plaintiff's claim that because TNT had a DOT license, that made them a broker, and that issue was directly addressed and dismissed in the Schramm case. So
I misunderstood that. You say because they had a DOT license that made...
That by definition would make them a motor carrier. Yes, thank you. I did find the reference to the non-delegable duty issue that was raised in the response brief by the plaintiff, and what it said in front of the lower court is, as a motor carrier, TNT has a non-delegable duty. The whole issue of non-delegable duty only arose once you buy into the initial premise, which is false, which is that we are a motor carrier. So that's the reason why it didn't present an issue for the district court judge in this particular case. The other argument that was made before the district court judge, or at least was framed by the pleadings, was an allegation of aiding and abetting under the federal motor carrier standards. The plaintiff's response brief before the lower court ignored that issue, and in footnote 8 of the district court's opinion, it's noted that that claim appears to have been abandoned because it was never addressed. So that gets us to the last issue, which is why does TNT have a common law duty? I've already discussed the fact that there is no allegation properly before the district court of that issue. Second question is, where would a duty arise from? Well, first of all, we know that there is an extensive statutory scheme that is already in place. So this is not a matter that the legislature hasn't considered. They know that there are brokers out there and people that arrange for travel, but when they put together the relevant federal statutes, they did not put a broker in that category. It's the plaintiff's position that we should create a common law duty that overcomes that and puts a broker in that position. I think that's improper. This is a situation where TNT had a contract with DeKaiser, and DeKaiser then had a contract with TLC, Transport Leasing. So you have Ms. Camp as an employee of TLC, which has a contract with DeKaiser, which has a contract with TNT. And there's actually no direct link between TNT and TLC, Ms. Camp's employer. The appellant's brief discusses a TNT-TLC contract. There is none. There are, in fact, two separate contracts, and there is no contractual relationship. So there is no special relationship between the parties that would give rise to a duty in this case.
So
and
in your view, who is the operator?
The operator, Your Honor, of the vehicle?
Under the motor vehicle regulations.
DeKaiser would be the motor carrier, Your Honor, because they actually hauled the load. And as between...
They own the truck?
Yes, Your Honor. And as between TLC and DeKaiser, I've never really considered those issues, whether TLC, as the employer of Lola Camp, could also be considered a motor carrier, but that was never an issue that came up before the court. The last item briefly to address is that there was a phone call that was made to TNT by Ms. Camp through her dispatcher at DeKaiser to TNT in which Ms. Camp indicated a concern of property damage, that the load might not be secure, and that she wanted to know if TNT would release her from any damage to the load that was done. No reference was made to any concern for personal safety whatsoever, and TNT simply said, if you want us to take responsibility for damage to the load, we'll do that, and you can write it on the bill of lading, and that's what she did. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ginsky, your time is up, but I will give you 1 minute if you have anything further in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the issue of open and obvious, it does not apply because nobody can see through the doors. Nobody's alleged that Lola Camp has X-ray vision and would be able to know that that in fact the load did shift. These are metal doors that are hinged side by side. She couldn't possibly know that that load had in fact shifted. And even if this court applies the open and obvious rationale, a deliberate encounter is an exception to the open and obvious rule. In other words, knowing that she loses her job if she doesn't deliver as she was told to do by TNT, that's a deliberate encounter. Contrary to what counsel for TNT said, it's not in the reply brief, but in plaintiff's original brief on page 22 that we make reference to the non-delegable duty of a motor carrier. In answer to Justice Ripple's question, the motor carrier here is TNT. We cite on page 26 of our brief no less than 11 facts that establish that they are just not an arranger of transportation. TNT determined whether or not the load or the trailers would have bracing materials. They determined that in this case, Lola Camp's trailer would not have bracing materials. They designed the load. When they talked with Lola Camp and her dispatcher, they knew that they and only they could say, we'll break that load, break that last pallet down, load it by hand. They're the only ones who have authority to do that. They didn't. They didn't expedite. They're much, much more than a mere broker. They are the motor carrier.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel, all counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.